This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
We're going to be talking this evening about a critical aspect of racial injustice in this country, specifically the experiences of black men and boys with the criminal justice system. To say these experiences have been fraught is, of course, a gross understatement. It's certainly been the case for decades, indeed for a couple of centuries, that blacks have themselves been victimized by the system. In recent years, the extent of the injustices has been highlighted thanks to several factors, the Black Lives Matter movement, and new technologies such as body cameras and smartphones that have helped document cases, and social media that have publicized the evidence. Many of the headlines have involved the tragic killings of unarmed blacks, among them Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Walter Scott, and Freddie Gray. But the problem is much broader, affecting a black male's experience in virtually every aspect of our justice system, from arrest through prosecution, sentencing, and incarceration. This is what Angela Davis set out to address when she assembled her new book, Policing the Black Man. Angela, who's right here, Angela has spent a good part of her own legal career researching and writing about racism and prosecutorial power in the criminal justice system. In the D.C. Public Defense Service, she worked her way up from staff attorney representing indigent juveniles and adults to director of the service. Now she's a professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law and a recognized expert in criminal law and procedure. A previous book, just over a decade ago, Arbitrary Justice, examined the power of American prosecutors. In Policing the Black Man, she's pulled together essays from a variety of scholars and writers, all specialists in criminal law and justice. The essays cover a range of issues: racial profiling, implicit bias, the disproportionate imprisonment of black men, the role of policing in the socialization of black boys, the failure of the Supreme Court and other official bodies to reform the system, and more. A review of the book in Kirkus called the book, quote, an absorbing anthology, scholarly yet approachable, and Publishers Weekly commended the collection as, quote, relentlessly informative and disturbing. Joining Angela this evening will be three contributors to the book. Sitting next to her is Chris Henning. She is a professor of law and director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic at Georgetown Law, and she's currently writing a book on the criminalization of black adolescents. Next to her is Renee McDonald Hutchins. She's the co-director of the clinical law program and a professor of public interest law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. She's the author of several scholarly works, including two books on criminal procedure. Now you can clap. And on the end there is Roger Fairfax Jr. He's a senior associate dean for academic affairs and professor of law at George Washington University, where he teaches courses in criminal law, procedure, and policy. So we'll hear from Angela first, and she'll moderate a discussion with the panelists, after which there'll be a chance for questions. If you have a question, kindly somehow make your way to that microphone or that microphone, and please put your question in the form of a question. Everybody would appreciate that. And now, please join me in welcoming Angela Davis.
Thank you, Brad, and thanks so much to everyone for being here. It's a lot of familiar faces, a lot of my colleagues from the Washington College of Law. Thank you so much for being here. Members of my Public Defender Service family, the DC Public Defender Service, I see a lot of you here. I see some of my students here hiding behind the books over there. I think some of my research assistants might be in the room. Great thanks to them as well. Gabrielle Best Husband, Cheryl Dublin, Layla Medina, Shantae Albro, Summer Woods, and Megan Mixon, and my family especially. My cousins, Deborah Owens and Deidre Owens, raise your hands, please. My daughter, Zara, who's supposed to be here, but I don't know, maybe she's out there somewhere, and especially my dear husband, Howard Davis. Thank you so much. Now, those of you who know me well know that I tried to figure out a way to photograph this event while I was in it, but I couldn't figure that out, and so I'm really grateful to Z Chatman, this phenomenal photographer, for taking photographs this evening. Thank you so much, Z. And I also want to thank someone who is not here today, and that is Professor Randall Kennedy of Harvard Law School. Some of you may have heard of Randy Kennedy. He's a phenomenal professor, Rhodes Scholar, the author of numerous books about race, discrimination, and civil rights, an editor at Penguin Random House, who's the publisher of our book and the publisher of many of Randy's books, approached Randy with this idea of producing an anthology that would explore and contextualize this awful phenomenon of the unjustified killings of black men and boys. And Randy so generously recommended me for the project, and for that, I am eternally grateful to him. I jumped at this opportunity because there is no issue more important to me than the unjust treatment of black and brown people in the criminal justice system at every step of the process, from arrest to sentencing. It is, in fact, the issue that keeps me up at night. I thought about who I would ask to join me in this project, and I decided to reach out to the authors, scholars, lawyers, advocates, and activists who have been teaching, writing about, litigating, advocating, agitating, and in many instances, living this issue. And I was so fortunate that so many of them said yes. I thank all of them, and now I want to personally thank three of them, not only for their brilliant essays, but for joining me here today. You heard very brief introductions of these three scholars. I wish I had more time to tell you all about them, but I urge you to research them and to learn about all of the great work they are doing. So thank you, Chris, Roger, and Renee, for writing and for being here today. I'm going to start out by just sort of giving you a bit of an overview of why this book and why now, and what we're trying to do with this book. And after I do that, then I'm going to engage in a discussion with my friends here. And I think the best way to do that is to read a brief excerpt from the introduction, so bear with me. Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, Sam Dubose, Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, and Terrence Crutcher are just some of the names on a long list of unarmed black boys and men who were killed by police officers in recent years. Although black men have been the victims of violence at the hands of the state since the time of slavery, technology and social media now permit us to literally bear witness to many of these killings repeatedly. Millions of people have watched the video of a police officer choking Eric Garner to death as he struggled for air. Similarly, millions have watched the video of a police officer shooting Walter Scott in the back as he ran for his life. Who can ever forget the grainy footage of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy who was shot by a police officer while he played alone with a toy gun in a park near his home? Two videos, one from a police helicopter and another from a police dashboard camera, show Terrence Crutcher walking away from police officers with his hands raised high in the air just before he was shot and killed. These images have evoked feelings of fear, sadness, and outrage, and serve as a reminder that the lives of black men and boys continue to be devalued and destroyed with impunity at the hands of the state. to date, not one of the police officers who killed these men and boys has been convicted of a single crime. From the arrival of the first slaves in Jamestown in 1619 to the lynchings of the 19th and 20th centuries to the present day, black boys and men have been unlawfully killed by those who were sworn to uphold the law and by vigilantes who took the law into their own hands. The National Museum of African American History and Culture, which opened its doors on September 24, 2016, includes exhibits that tell the story of many of these killings. Yet these killings are not just a part of African American history. They have continued well into the 21st century, almost 400 years after the beginning of slavery, and persist with remarkable frequency and brutality during a time when America elected its first African American president. Many of these race-based killings have inspired and reinvigorated movements for change. The brutal killing of 14-year-old Emmett Till in Mississippi in 1955, the murder of civil rights activist Medgar Evers in 1963, and the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968 all serve as markers on the civil rights movement timeline, as did so many other killings of black men by white racists. Each tragic killing sparked nationwide protests and renewed activism in the struggle for civil rights and racial justice in the United States. The killing of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in 2012 was a pivotal marker of racial violence against black men in the 21st century. And I won't tell, I'll skip over the story of how he was killed because I'm sure you're all familiar with it. The killing of Trayvon Martin, the initial failure of the prosecutor to charge Zimmerman with a crime, and Zimmerman's ultimate acquittal captured the attention of the nation. President Obama even weighed in, stating, "Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago." Martin's killing also inspired the phrase "Black Lives Matter." The phrase trended on Twitter and all forms of social media and was displayed on posters carried in protests after Martin's killing and after every killing of a black man or woman by a police officer from that day forward. Black Lives Matter ultimately became a social justice movement with chapters throughout the United States and Canada. Many unarmed black men and boys have been killed since Trayvon Martin's tragic death 5 years ago. Many of the killings occurred after police officers arguably engaged in racial profiling, stopping and harassing these men for no explainable reason other than the color of their skin. In all of the cases where black men were shot and killed, the officers claimed that they felt threatened, even though the men were unarmed and often running away or retreating. In almost all of the cases, the police officers were never even arrested or charged with a crime. The tragic killings of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Walter Scott, Tamir Rice, Freddie Gray, and others served as the catalyst for this anthology. But these killings also inspired the contributing authors to think about all of the ways that black men are policed in the broad sense of the word, heavily and harshly at every step of the criminal process. In fact, black men are policed and treated worse than their similarly situated white counterparts at every step of the criminal justice system, from arrest through sentencing. These unwarranted disparities exist whether black men are charged with crimes or are victims of crimes. Police officers stop, search, and arrest black men far more frequently than white men engaged in the same behavior. Prosecutors charge black men more frequently and with more serious crimes than white men who engage in the same behavior. And there are disproportionate numbers of black men in the nation's prisons and jails. Criminal defendants, regardless of their race, are punished less harshly when their victims are black men. And this anthology explores and explains the policing of black men from slavery to the present day and at every stage of the criminal process and beyond. So just want to list for you very briefly the titles to hopefully whet your appetite of these phenomenal essays. The first was written by Brian Stevenson. Some of you may be familiar with him, the author of Just Mercy and the director of the Equal Justice Institute. His essay is called A Presumption of Guilt, The Legacy of America's History of Racial Injustice. The next chapter is by Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project, The Endurance of Racial Disparity in the Criminal Justice System. Then Chris Henning's brilliant essay, Boys to Men, love that title, Boys to Men, The Role of Policing in the Socialization of Black Boys. And her chapter is followed by Renee's, Racial Profiling, The Law, the Policy, and the Practice. Then Catherine Russell Brown's essay, Black Men and the Police, Making Implicit Bias Explicit. That chapter is followed by Tracy Mears and Tom Tyler's chapter called Policing, A Model for the 21st Century. That chapter is followed by my own contribution and chapter called The Prosecution of Black Men. After that is Roger's chapter, The Grand Jury and Police Violence Against Black Men, followed by Ron Wright's chapter called Elected Prosecutors and Police Accountability, and then followed by Sherilyn Eiffel, Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. She co-authored a chapter with Jen He Lee, also from her office, called Do Black Lives Matter to the Courts? And the final chapter by Jeremy Travis and Bruce Western is called Poverty, Violence, and Black Incarceration. So I hope those titles have gotten you somewhat interested. I want to start out now, and I think I'm going to go back to the, and I'm going to ask Chris first. So you just heard about Chris's chapter, which is about black boys, and I just want to ask you, Chris, your essay, Boys to Men, The Role of Policing and the Socialization of Black Boys, helps us to understand the interplay between black boys and the police and how black boys are socialized to interact with the police. So can you tell us a little bit about that? And particularly, I'd love for you to talk about and perhaps read a little bit from your chapter about how black boys interact with the police during on-the-street encounters.
So, first of all, thank you so much, Angela, for not only allowing me to come here today to join you, but also for asking me to join your book. So let me start by saying that, you know, I argue that black boys are policed like no one else in society. So if we think about typical adolescent engagement with the police, adolescents have, in general, more contact with the police than average adults in their schools, on the streets, on the bus, all of the public places in which they engage. And think about typical adolescent behavior. They ride around in cars together. They hang out in big groups. They draw the attention of the police by talking back, laughing, joning, and the like. And in addition, they are subject to arrest for minor status offenses for which adults can't even be arrested. But then I argue that even beyond sort of this increased attention to youth by the police, that the reality is that our society today is uniquely afraid of black boys. You've already talked about Tamir Rice. How is it that a 12-year-old boy gets shot by the police when there's a 911 call that says someone by a recreation facility, a playground essentially, might be there with a fake pistol? And so when the police officers are questioned and the prosecutors are questioned, they repeatedly talk about how old that Tamir Rice looked, right? Everybody remember they kept talking about his 36 size pants, and he was 5'7", and he looked much older than 12 years old. He was 170 pounds. But the reality is, the research shows that the implicit racial bias research shows that we as a society, the public in general, and police officers in particular, tend to overestimate the age of black children by amount of like 4.5 years older than they actually are. And this reality has a tremendous impact on the way police officers interact with black youth. It means that black youth can be harassed, assaulted, and even shot for engaging in typical normal adolescent behavior. And so what we thought might make sense is just to read some excerpts from a couple of pages that talk about how police officers interact with black youth, and more importantly, how, as it goes to this question of legal socialization or how children are socialized to perceive police officers, but how black boys feel and react when they are engaged or approached by police officers. So, black boys are angered not only at the sheer number of police officers patrolling their neighborhoods, but also by the frequency with which they are stopped and the treatment that they experience and observed. Children grow up watching their friends and family members accosted for minor infractions like not wearing a seatbelt, having the windows too tinted, and playing the radio too loud. Black boys describe their neighborhoods as besieged by police who stop them like 5-6 times a day just to pat them down and ask them questions. Under the guise of reasonable, articulable suspicion, police stop black boys on the vaguest of descriptions. Black boys running, two black males in jeans, one in a gray hoodie, black male in athletic gear, black male with a bicycle. Young black males are treated as if they are out of place, not only when they are in white middle class neighborhoods, but also when they are hanging out in public spaces or sitting on their own front porches. Black boys who congregate on the corner attract the attention of police at all times of the day or night. Young black males cannot escape police surveillance even when they dress nicely or drive nice cars, because such signs of wealth among black youth are presumed to be associated with drug dealing. When black boys are stopped, police pepper them with questions like, "Where are you coming from? Where are you going?" Consider Tremaine McMillan's encounter with a Miami-Dade police officer who demanded that Tremaine point out his mother, suggesting that he did not believe the 14-year-old was legitimately at the beach with his family. The pervasiveness of these intrusions is debilitating for black boys. Boys in St. Louis maintain that officers treat them as if they are always criminal. Black boys and black girls complain that police are mean and disrespectful and do not know how to talk to people, especially black people. Black boys describe police as belligerent and antagonistic and are especially outraged by the officers' use of inflammatory language, including racial slurs, profanity, and demeaning terms like punk and sissy. Racial slurs and profanity have been particularly damaging to youth's perception of police legitimacy and moral authority. Black boys also take particular exception to being told to assume the position, put their hands on the hood, wall, or car, or sit and lie on a sidewalk. They resent strip searches and cavity probes and being told to pull down their pants or take off their clothes, especially when there is no obvious rationale for such an order. Police stops involving black boys are routinely initiated by some physical contact, such as grabbing, pushing, shoving, pulling, or tackling youth to the ground. Once on the ground, black boys like Emilio Mayfield are often held down by multiple officers who sit or lie on them while other officers kick, punch, or mace them. Even more violent encounters include billy clubs, like the one that was pressed against Emilio's neck as he was jaywalking at 8 o'clock in the morning on his way to school, or chokeholds like the one killing Eric Garner in New York, or the one that caused Tremaine McMillan to wet his pants on a Miami beach. Fear of violence by the police is now the norm for black boys. Instead of looking to the police for protection, young black boys now see police as a primary source of danger and are conditioned to expect mistreatment. In interview after interview, young black males speak of policing in black neighborhoods as repressive, obtrusive, and insidious. They describe the exercise of police discretion as arbitrary and racially biased. The cumulative impact of these experiences erodes police legitimacy at an early age for black boys and weakens the value of law and order. The net result is that black youth come to expect unfair treatment and carry these feelings and expectations into adulthood.
Thank you so much for that powerful reading.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, what do black boys do with all of this? But yeah, maybe we can do that in the Q&A part. I hope that'll come up. I'll ask you that question if
okay.
No one else does.
I got an answer for you.
Because I want you to.
Thank
all
you
right.
So much for that.
You can stay right there.
So, Renee, your essay, Racial Profiling, the Law, the Policy, and the Practice, helps us to understand this phenomenon of racial profiling. Everybody knows that term. but in Renee's chapter, she really explains in great detail and what it really means. So if you can just explain briefly, what is racial profiling, and also tell us a little bit about the harms that it causes.
Okay. So good evening. So there are a couple of different ways to think about racial profiling, right? Let's imagine that the police are doing routine crime patrol over on Davenport. And it's about 3:30 in the morning, and they see a man walking by himself. He is dressed sort of shabbily. He's got on kind of dirty sweatpants. He has on an undershirt. His hair isn't really combed. He doesn't have a dog with him, so he doesn't appear to be walking a dog. And he's walking a little too slowly to be exercising. And as he's walking, he seems to be kind of looking in cars and looking in apartment windows. And so the police decide to stop him, right? If this man is black, one way to think about racial profiling would be to ask, is the only reason the police stopped him because he is black? That's one way to conceptualize racial profiling. And if the answer to that question is yes, the Constitution would say you can't do that. Another way to conceptualize racial profiling, though, would be to ask, would the police have stopped him if he were white, right? Is the fact that he was a black man walking on the street in the early morning hours without any apparent purpose and appearing to be a little disheveled, was that a part of the reason, but was another part of the reason for the stop his race? That's sort of a race plus understanding of racial profiling. And what the court has said is that's not unconstitutional, right? When the police have other objective reasons for detaining citizens, race can be a factor. It just can't be the only factor. And that makes it very, 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 very difficult to combat the problem, because only the most tone-deaf police officer cannot come up with a rationale other than race for why they make the stop, right? It is clear, for as much as this country struggles with the issue of race, we have come to the conclusion that being a racist is bad. And so when the Supreme Court sets up a constitutional test that only prohibits racial profiling when we are hunting for the racist, it is almost impossible to use the courts to combat the problem. Another way to think about racial profiling is the way that it happened up in a county in upstate New York. So one of the things that most or a lot of police departments and a lot of prosecutors' offices have said is you cannot consider race as a factor in making stops unless the race was something provided by an eyewitness. So there was a woman, elderly woman staying in a home. She was visiting some friends up in Oneonta. And she was staying in a home. The home was broken into. She struggled with her attacker, and I believe the attacker came in with a knife and cut his hand. She sort of fended off her attacker, and the attacker cut his hand and fled. And so she provided a description of her attacker to the police who showed up at the home after the break-in. She said it was a young black man, but she couldn't provide much of a description beyond that. The Oneonta Police Department then went about stopping 300 black men in Oneonta, New York, and one black woman, and asked them all to display their hands, right? These were forcible stops. These folks were not free to walk away, and asked them all to display their hands so that they could determine if they were the attacker. And so in that instance, what the 300 black men in Oneonta argued was, this has got to be a violation of the Constitution. I understand this woman gave a description that provided race, and I understand that the courts have said and the police departments and the prosecutors' offices who have set up guidelines have said, if the witness gives a description that includes race, it's okay to use race. That doesn't violate the Constitution. And the Supreme Court said, no, actually, it's okay. Actually, that's okay. They did not find a constitutional violation because the use of race was based upon an eyewitness's description. And so that is a part of the way the court has interpreted racial profiling that makes it very, very, very difficult to challenge. Harms.
My question was,
the harm, if you can talk a little bit about the harms.
Okay.
Because a lot of people, I think, well, you know, if you get stopped, what's the big deal? Right. Talk a little bit about the harms.
And so I think that the problems with racial profiling, I discuss this in the chapter, is in many ways the same problem that we have with race in this country. You really cannot decouple our treatment of race in this country from the police use of race and the prosecutor's race in terms of racial profiling. And so one of the problems is that we view the harm of racial profiling as very localized, right? As we drive past comfortably in our cars and happen to glance out the window and see a group of young black men sitting on the side of the street, perhaps in handcuffs, perhaps not, we go, oh, for shame. That shouldn't be happening. But we really don't internalize any of that harm for the most part because we don't believe it affects us, unless in some way it does, right? So I've got two beautiful young black men who are my sons in the back. And so when I see pictures of Tamir Rice, you guys don't have to raise your hands. I'm sorry for embarrassing you. They're gonna get me for that. So when I saw pictures of Tamir Rice, when I saw pictures of Trayvon Martin, my heart broke. I could not stop crying after the picture because I looked at those pictures and I saw those two. And so in that way, the harm for me felt very immediate and very local. But if you don't have a person in your life that reminds you of the victim of racial profiling, you may view it as not my problem, right? Sort of unfortunate, but not my problem. Except it is. Racial profiling destabilizes communities in very, very, very negative ways. There have been some studies that show that the vicarious exposure to the damage of racial profiling can even do so much as suppress votes. Instability is a threat to democracy. And so when we have large segments of a population whose only experience with government is as an arbitrary and vindictive overseer, that destabilizes our democracy in very real ways, and that's something I think we should all be concerned about, right? Was it Martin Luther King who said riots are the language of the unheard? And so we can only pretend to ignore these problems for so long. They will come to touch our doorsteps eventually. And so for that reason, I think we should care very much about racial profiling, even if it's not happening to you, even if it's not happening to yours, even if you don't have a Tamir Rice and Trayvon Martin sitting in your home that you kiss and put to bed every night, right? We should all care deeply if we care about democracy.
Thank you so much, Renee, for those powerful words. Thank you. So, Roger, your essay is entitled The Grand Jury and Police Violence Against Black Men. And in the few cases that we know about where prosecutors actually presented the cases to the grand jury's rarely returned an indictment. Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice come to mind. Explain very briefly what the grand jury is, first of all, and talk a little bit about why indictments are so rare in these cases.
Well, thank you for that question, Angela, and thank you in general. I know some of us call her Angela, some of us call her Imani, and I call her amazing because she is really one of the most generous and passionate people I have encountered in the legal academy, in the practice of law, in policy circles, and I feel very blessed and fortunate to call you my friend. So thank you very much for having me. And I want to thank all of you for coming out. I see so many family and friends and former and current colleagues here. And as I mentioned, you know, Angela is amazing. And like with our shared mentor, Charles Ogletree, whenever Angela asks me to do something, I just say yes and then figure out how to do it later. And
I did have to beg right.
No, not at all. But if there had to be a little bit of persuasion, it really is because this was one of the most difficult tasks I've encountered as a scholar thus far. And I'll tell you why. First of all, as a scholar, I am a proceduralist. And proceduralists are chiefly concerned with the content and the quality of procedures. Now, those procedures obviously lead to substantive decisions, but a pure proceduralist is concerned with the constitutional provisions or statutory provisions that give rise to the procedures that then lead to the substantive outcomes. But when you have time after time procedures that lead to unjust outcomes, like trial procedures that lead to wrongful convictions, like bail procedures that lead to lengthy pretrial detention without justification, like sentencing procedures that lead to mass incarceration, and like grand jury procedures that lead to outcomes where almost never are police officers indicted for the killing of unarmed black men, the proceduralist has to question whether his or her work is relevant or worthy. So that was one of the difficulties for me. Another difficulty was the fact that the cases that I mine for academic insight in my chapter are stories of real people, real men, real boys, real lives that were snatched, not only from them, but from their loved ones. And in the same vein as Renee just mentioned, this was made all the more poignant for me because Michael Brown was killed weeks before starting college as a first year, and my oldest daughter was starting college that same summer. And so to see someone snatched from the prime of their life, you know, on the cusp of beginning a new chapter was poignant for me. Laquan McDonald is the same age as my middle daughter, who is here tonight, and whose killing helped to shape a generation. You mentioned Black Lives Matter and all of the activism, and she is a summer intern at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, a fact of which I'm very proud, but that's part of the reaction to what's happening. And then Renee embarrassed her two sons. I have to embarrass my baby girl, who is a rising eighth grader, but she was the same age as Tamir Rice when he was gunned down for playing with a toy gun in a playground in an open carry state. And so when I think about these tragedies that come with depressing frequency, it really made it difficult to think about this from an academic standpoint and to try to mine insight from those. And when you think about the fact that there are six stories in my chapter, and that number seems inadequate to capture what was going on in that period in America, tells you that something has gone off the rails. And then finally, as a black man who has been policed his whole life, and I see my good friend from childhood, Kenny McDuffie, the Ward 5 council member, and he and I grew up together, and he can tell you, we were policed. What Chris talked about in her chapter was a daily occurrence for us, with jump out patrols, jumping out, patting us down, no reason, no cause, sometimes taking the money we had in our pockets and keeping it, even though we earned them from legitimate jobs. We had earned those monies. And so I've lived that my whole life, and it continues. I look out on Connecticut Avenue, my route driving home from work. I've been stopped more times than I want to count on that street. And every time I am stopped, it's hard to understand, but this goes to what you were saying, Chris. I feel like I will not survive that encounter. I feel like I may be killed. I may not make it home to my wife who's standing there as a result of that encounter. So I offer that manufactured respect that you have to give in order to try to make it through an encounter. I narrate every movement. I'm reaching to disengage my seatbelt. I'm reaching to my glove compartment where my registration is. You may hear a noise when it opens. Don't be alarmed, right? That is, I'm walking the officer through steps to avoid having him or her reach for the service weapon and shoot me. And all the while, I understand and acknowledge that after seeing that chilling video of Philando Castile, no matter how much narration I engage in, I can't guarantee that, in fact, I still won't be killed as a result of that encounter. So with all of that baggage, I embarked on the task of trying to make sense of the grandeur. And I have 2 minutes, and that's all I need. I only need 2 minutes because I'm going to give you a hint. I can save you some time. You can skip over my chapter and read all the other brilliant chapters in this book, because I'm going to tell you what I have to say right now in a minute, 30 seconds, all right? And what I have to say is I don't have the answer, okay? I can't make sense of these grand jury decisions. I certainly go through the history and the structure of the grand jury. I look at certain features of the grand jury, like secrecy and the demographic makeup of the grand jury, to determine whether there are some tweaks we can make around the margins that might enhance the likelihood of getting an indictment in one of these cases. But in the end, my conclusion is that the one fix worth mentioning has very little to do with the grand jury itself. And it has to do with what Angela wrote about, and that is the prosecutor. It's the independence of the prosecutor that is the most important factor in determining whether or not there is a fair proceeding before the grand jury. You have to understand that obviously police officers and prosecutors work hand in hand, day in and day out. Police officers are the investigators for prosecutors. They're their witnesses. Prosecutors help to prosecute suspects apprehended by the police, and they develop their cases in court. Of course they have mutual respect and admiration for one another. In fact, if they didn't have affinity for each other, I'd think something were amiss. But that's exactly the reason why you cannot have the prosecutor be the one to investigate the police officers in that same jurisdiction. There has to be independence, and I understand the argument that we deserve some sort of community representation in the prosecution of police officers, and people I respect, like Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney in Baltimore, and the late former Brooklyn DA Ken Thompson, have made forceful arguments that no, it should be us, those of us prosecuting in the community, who should go after the police officers in those communities. And I appreciate that argument, but ultimately, even if there isn't substantive bias in favor of the police on the part of the prosecutor in the community, the perception of that bias undermines public confidence in the outcome of those proceedings. And for that reason alone, we need to focus on ensuring that prosecutors in these cases are independent. So with that, I will sit down and look forward to Q&A.
Thank you so much, Roger. And I'm actually glad you spent so much time talking about your experience before getting to talking about the grand jury, because you really captured it so well. And do read his chapter, because he does explain all of that. So now it's time for Q&A, and so I'm told that if you have a question, you would need to make your way up to one of these microphones. There's one over here, and there's one here. While people are coming to the microphone, I will say this about my own chapter, The Prosecution of Black Men, and just to piggyback on what Roger said, my feeling is prosecutors are the most important officials in the criminal justice system. They have more power than anyone. They have more discretion than anyone. They're the ones who drive the decision. But on the other hand, they're the ones who can fix it, but only if we get good, progressive people running for office. You need to know who your district attorney or your state attorney is. If you're in the District of Columbia, it's different because it's not a state, it's a U.S. attorney. You don't get to vote for them. I understand that's a whole nother talk. But if you're in Maryland or Virginia where you can vote, you need to pay attention to who your DA is. You mentioned Marilyn Mosby. Again, people need to, it's fine that she came out and went after the cops, but we need to ask her what she's doing every day in Baltimore City with regard to all the black and brown people who are held pretrial without bond and who are locked up, and why is it that Baltimore has all of that, those horrible racial disparities. While people are cheering her on about prosecuting the cops, they need to ask her those questions too, with all due respect. Jenny Lyman.
Surprise,
and you can
surprise.
Identify yourself or not identify yourself, but I'm able to identify our first person. You have a question.
It was an accurate eyewitness ID. The killing of Philander Castile helped me, also my son helped me, to reframe the problem in a way that I wonder if you all could address. He said, look, even if you're talking the NRA, and I'm not usually one for gun rights as a cause, but black men do not have the right to carry guns. And that's one of the things that killing made absolutely graphically clear, was that he was legally carrying the gun, and that was what ultimately led to his death, besides all the other things. So I wonder if you could talk on this panel about the other things that we take for granted as freedoms that young black men in particular don't have. Because and if you reframe it like that, then maybe some people on a different part of the political spectrum could get behind this.
Sure. No, you all jump right in there.
So I actually think that one of the things that we are about to see that's about to be extremely interesting is a collision course between the Second Amendment and the Fourth Amendment. So the Fourth Amendment, just to summarize, gives us the right to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. The Second Amendment, according to the Supreme Court, gives individuals a right to bear arms. And the way that I think the court has been defining reasonable suspicion and the right to stop, temporarily detain people and frisk people for weapons is on a direct collision course with the Second Amendment right to bear arms. And in a very odd way, right, the NRA, I think, may become a friend of the liberal cause with regard to libertarians who are interested in Fourth Amendment rights. And it will not initially be on behalf of poor black men in the inner city. It will initially be on behalf of people taking over forestry service offices. But the beautiful thing about the law is, right, that once something becomes precedent, you can take that precedent and use it on different facts. And so I actually think the point that you have made is going to be a very interesting point that we need to keep an eye on, that the Second Amendment and the Fourth Amendment are about to collide in ways that I'm not sure the courts see them colliding in terms of the way they're setting up the law.
And I don't know, Chris, if you want to add anything, because I think, Jenny, you were asking what are some of the things that, you know, everybody, white folk can do that black folks can't do, or black boys and men
right.
can't do, such
right.
as just being and
right.
standing
breathing.
On
right.
on the
right.
corner.
No,
maybe you want to say a word or two about
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I mean, and let me, exactly, there we go. I was going straight there for the First Amendment. I talk in my chapter about, you know, black boys do not have the privilege of resistance, right? They don't have the privilege of asking questions. Why are you stopping me?
About assembly.
Assembly, right. And, you know, on a street, right? And I think what is so profoundly dangerous about the interaction between police officers and children and adolescents is something that Roger sort of got to, which is this notion that when he is stopped, he is terrified, and so he's very rational and intentional about his behavior. What do we know about adolescents? They are impulsive. They react. They talk back. They don't think ahead to the consequences, right? And so they resist. They speak out. They protest in the best way they know how.
And all of that is supposed to be legal, correct?
Exactly. Exactly. That's, you know, yeah. that's your point. And they are subject to even more danger for speaking out, for resisting. And they resist in ways that aren't professional. They aren't respectful, and that put them in greater danger. So they don't even have the right to the First Amendment right to speak right. and congregate.
Thank you. Second question. I know the second person who's speaking, Debbie Owens. I'll identify you as well. Question.
Hi, this has been a great panel. Can you hear me?
Now.
This has been a great panel. I guess my question was prompted by your presentation, Chris. And it's something that concerns me. And it's when we talk about young black and brown boys who grow up being literally terrorized by the police, is there any research out there that shows what impact does this have on their development and how they develop later in life? What I'm concerned about is the dehumanization I see. These are 12-year-olds, these are 10-year-olds. And for us to think that they should be okay after they've been repeatedly and once is too much traumatized, what research is out there? And if it happens to someone in my immediate family, what tools or resources are available to ensure that this experience has no long-term damaging effects to their development and their overall well-being? Because we don't talk about that. We act as if it's normal that a 12-year-old should be thrown up against a car two or three times a month and then go home and do their homework. And I don't think we would expect that of white boys.
Right. No, I think that's absolutely right. I think it's a fabulous question, and I think there's not enough research on it. I will say, I think it was mentioned earlier that I'm working on some research around the criminalization of normal adolescents, and part of that is what is the traumatic impact on black boys, I think, in schools? What impact does it have for a child to walk into to a school every day through a metal detector, school resource officers, high security profile. So all that to say, I don't have the answer for you today. I am certainly working on it. And part of, I think the work has to be around collecting, partnering with psychologists who can study specifically this nuanced question. So it's not a complete answer. Right, exactly.
So exactly. Next question on this side. Is there a question over here? Yes.
I think I'm brand new. I'm Wanji Gongare, and thank you so much for the presentation today. I guess to start with just a quick couple sentences of background, I grew up in an immigrant family of African parents who didn't have the language or the history or the experience of really explaining this experience to my brother or to myself. So our first experience or really conversation around this was Trayvon Martin as well, because my brother and Trayvon Martin are about 5 days apart in age. And so that was a very jarring experience, and I've had a little bit of hope in the last few years with everything that's going on in terms of the movement and as we grow up to a certain extent. But I guess my worry now with, unfortunate to bring this up, the new administration, it feels like on a federal level, we definitely will be taking several steps backwards. So to be more tactical, what are the one to two things maybe we should watch out from Mr. Sessions and crew? We should watch out for in terms of what we can actually do as the public and what we can raise awareness about.
Well, first we need to pray for our brother Mueller, who's investigating, and make sure he does his job well. Send him some flowers and pray over him. That's point number one. If you don't pray, meditate on him. But on serious note, you know, it's horrible. You know, Jeff Sessions is trying to roll back the clock on all the progress that Attorneys General Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch made. The consent decrees that were put in place in Baltimore, which is still standing firm. Hopefully the judge is still hanging in there. And in Ferguson. So he wants to undo all of that. So far hasn't been able to do that. He's directing all of the U.S. attorneys to charge at the highest level, going against all that the research has shown about how that doesn't work and doesn't make us safer. But and so it's horrible. So hopefully he'll be gone soon, and all of those folks will be gone soon. But the one thing to focus on is the fact that only about 10% of all criminal cases are handled in federal court. The other 90% are on the state and local level. And that's why I tell folks, pay attention to your state and local prosecutors who are elected officials. Pay attention to the mayors who appoint most, in most jurisdictions, it's the mayor that appoints the police chiefs. So we want to get progressive-minded people in those positions so that they can make decisions that are different from the decisions that have been made over the past several decades. And I'm happy to say in this last election in 2016, there were some decent progressive prosecutors that were elected. Aramis Ayala in Orlando, look her up if you haven't already. Rick Scott has tried to remove her from all death penalty eligible cases because she said she wasn't going to seek the death penalty, and she is now suing him, represented by the able Roy Austin, and hopefully that will work out. Kim Fox is the new prosecutor in Chicago, who unseated Anita Alvarez, who hid the videotape showing Laquan McDonald being killed by police officers there, and Kim Fox is doing all kinds of progressive things around bail, and there are many others. So what we can do, and there's so many things, and I will stop now because I want to get more clear, but that's one thing we can do. And in terms of the federal government, again, when it comes to criminal justice, pay attention. Yes, we got to fight Sessions and all of them, but really pay attention on the state and local level. I don't know if anybody wanted to.
Well, and just to piggyback on that, this wave of prosecutors in the most recent election and the election before that are often termed smart on crime prosecutors. And really, one of the leaders of that wave was now Senator Kamala Harris, who was in the Bay Area and then became Attorney General of California and now represents the state in the United Senate. Angela also Brooks, another local prosecutor, Craig Watkins, formerly down in Dallas, and Carl Racine here in the district. And what that shows others seeking office is not only, number one, can you win on that progressive platform, but that voters are beginning to expect that you articulate a platform that goes beyond how many people you seek to lock up, and instead how you're going to make us safer by taking investments from mass incarceration and allowing them to be put towards schools and hospitals and bridges and roads by being smart on criminal justice policy and moving away from those tough on crime policies of yesteryear, which again are starting to rear their ugly head now, but hopefully will be back down.
And just to add one very brief thing, the other thing when you were talking about it being at the state level, and when I was talking earlier about us not understanding the harm being widespread, we pay for mass incarceration at the state level. Your tax dollars pay for that. It is not an efficient use of resources. So to the extent that you speak up with regard to the abuse of other tax dollars and the way other tax dollars are being spent, you might want to think about talking about this too. We pay an astronomical amount of money to lock folks up, and it doesn't make us safer. So even if you want to be tough on crime, let's be smart on crime in a way that actually makes us safer. And locking lots and lots and lots of people up doesn't do it.
Thank you. Question?
Yes, this is somewhat tactical as well, and I think you partially answered it. But I do want to thank you for elaborating on the constitutional standard for racial profiling. My question is around the standard that is used for police officers. Mm-hmm. I helped put together a community policing forum in Northern Virginia, and I had a conversation with an officer. Now, when I and maybe a lot of people look at these videos, we think what a reasonable officer would do under similar circumstances. And he shared with me that the standard isn't about a reasonable officer, it's about what he or she thought in a split second, regardless of the circumstances. And then he began to share that there was a case, I may be butchering this, so please school me, but that there was a case in the 60s, apparently, that set this standard in the Supreme Court. So I'm wondering, A, can you expound on it, and B, why have we not, and what can we do, and do you need some free labor to help you do it? Try a case, you know, find that perfect case or halfway perfect that has a set of facts such that we can bring it up to the federal level, to the Supreme Court. God knows what the composition of the court will look like at that point. But I'm just wondering, you know, why hasn't it been done? You know, I'm sure people have tried, and if you could just share, be grateful.
Okay, so the really short version, the one-minute version, I swear, of Terry. So prior to 65, Terry was 65, I think. 68, I'm all at mid to late 60s.
Hey, 68.
Thank you. So prior to 68 and the Terry versus Ohio decision, it used to be the rule that the police could not stop you unless they had probable cause to believe you had committed a crime. This country erupted in all kinds of social violence in the 60s that made a lot of folk very nervous that crime was taking over our streets. And there was a very, very, very deliberate effort on the part of some Republican politicians to take advantage of that fear and advance a law and order agenda. In that environment, the Supreme Court decided this case called Terry versus Ohio, and what they did in Terry was loosen the reins on police officers. And they allowed police officers to engage in what we call brief detentions if they had something less than probable cause, if they had what we call reasonable articulable suspicion, which is a lower standard than probable cause. It means they just have to reasonably believe that you are engaged or about to engage in criminal conduct. And so under that looser standard, police were now able to stop folks on the street, even if they didn't have probable cause to believe they'd engaged in any crime, even if they just had a really strong suspicion. What came with Terry, the other part that came with Terry, was the right to frisk people. So again, it used to be you could only search people under the Constitution if you had probable cause or a warrant. That used to be the rule. Under Terry, if they had reason to believe that you were armed and presently dangerous, and the courts have since wound those two together, right? Armed is presently dangerous, even in open carry states, that if you are armed and presently dangerous, they could also frisk you. That is a lot of power. a lot of power. So if the police, I'll get back to my, remember in the beginning when I was talking about the guy walking down the street in his shabby pants and it's 3:30 in the morning, right? If a police officer can look at that person and say, I think they may be about to be engaged in a break-in, they can stop you. And if they can point to anything that leads them to believe you may also be armed, a bulge, the way you're holding your hand, your nervousness, they can also search you. And anything that they find, if that search is deemed constitutional, can be used against you in a court of law. Even if that's not at all why they were originally stopping you, right? They find drugs on you, you can actually be prosecuted for the possession of drugs. What can we do about it? Well, we need a different court, right? We are not going to overturn Terry with this court. It's not going to happen. And so what we are seeing is some state courts are finding that they, under their state constitutions, are going to be more protective of our Fourth Amendment rights than the Supreme Court is, but lots of state courts aren't. And so it is going to require concerted action on the part of people saying, our Fourth Amendment rights have to mean more than this. The right to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures has to mean more than what the court has said. That's the only way we're going to change it.
Thank you. Question.
My name is Phyllis Lawrence. I've been involved with restorative justice and victim advocacy and offender advocacy for many years. Hi, Chris. I would like y'all to address where you see restorative justice practices, victim offender dialogue, police accused dialogue, or even police convicted dialogue, as a possibility for reducing that trauma, particularly with juveniles that people were mentioning a while ago.
I think this is a hard question. I knew somebody was going to ask about solutions, and so I've decided to say that I'm an eternal optimist for no other reason than, why are we in the work? And so some of the studies, some of the best practices regarding youth have involved some of the conversations that you described, sort of the mediated conversations between police officers and children, more on the front end than on the back end. And so when I say the front end, it's talking about, it's engaging the two groups in a conversation about how, in particular, police officers need to learn how adolescents think and behave, right? So that's part one. And police officers need to understand how to de-escalate adolescent behaviors. Police officers need to understand how to interpret normal adolescents as not being threatening and aggressive, that kind of thing. At the same time, adolescents need to understand where police officers are coming from, for lack of a better word. So there have been some model pilot projects across the country. Connecticut is an example where these, Philadelphia has had one, where these projects have come about. So, I'm an eternal optimist. I think I reference a couple of them in the chapter, and if not, I know I do in this chapter and then a couple of other places. But so, I'm an optimist. You have to be able to sit still and have the conversation. I will say, I see Christy Lopez is here, Paul Butler is here. There's a group of faculty at Georgetown who have been working on a Policing for Tomorrow Fellowship, which attempts to engage police officers at the front end, in the as cadets in the academy, to get them to think differently about policing across all of these domains, implicit racial bias, adolescent development, and the like. So, I'm an eternal optimist, and that's my story. I'm sticking to it.
Thank you, Chris. I'm told we have time for one, maybe two, depending on how long this first one is. If it's short, we may have time for two. Do we have one over here? I'm trying to go back and forth.
He wants to say something. Let me make sure.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, and I thank you all for the work you're doing. Obviously, I'm a black man, 20-something, but I'm also a middle school teacher, so I'm very appreciative of your work. My question is, given the scenario, the case that's just occurred in Minneapolis, I want to know what impact do you think, if any, will this case have on the dialogue that we're having? And for those who may not be aware, there was an Australian white woman who was shot and killed by a Somalian black police officer. So what impact do you think that case and the results will have on this dialogue?
Well, I will say this. I mean, it's very early on, but depending on how it's resolved, it may unfortunately sort of prove the points that we're all making here about race, right? Because here you have a white woman who was tragically killed, apparently for no reason,
by a black police officer. And we've talked about how none of these police officers in the cases we've mentioned where black boys and men have been killed have been convicted, oftentimes not charged. It will just be interesting to see, you know, how this is handled, whether that black police officer is charged, if he is convicted. And I think I'm watching it. You know, it'll be interesting to see. I don't know if anybody else has a comment to make about that. Yeah. Last question.
A lot of pressure.
Not at all.
Hi, I'm Dana Pope, and I'm an activist. I work with people here in D.C. I actually live in Maryland, but this is where most of the activism has been happening in the time I've been here. So Black Lives Matter D.C. and BYP 100, they are pushing for abolition, right? Police abolition.
Of prisons?
Prison and police abolition. And so I'm just curious in terms of, I know that all of you are lawyers and academics, but in terms of trying to address the things that you just referred to, like the police killing anyone is actually a problem. And I'm not like a White Lives Matter, that's absolutely not what I'm saying. But police have always been representing the interests of rich white men, right? And so that means killing whoever happens to be not doing the right thing according to those standards. So I'm just wondering if there's anything in your research or in your colleagues' research or in the things that you're sort of see bubbling up in these topics that point to ways to get at abolition of police and prisons.
Does anybody want to talk about prison abolition, police abolition?
Well,
comments?
You mentioned Paul Butler, and I think
Paul, come to Paul's, the stage now. Just
wave your hand, Paul. And in his, yes, Paul, yes, round of applause.
So most of you know Paul Butler or know who he is. He had a talk here. It's a wonderful book called Chokehold, Policing Black Men, that also came out the same day as our book came out, and he's done wonderful work. And so you should read his book as well, and you probably will see a lot more of discussion of that issue at that time. So I think that's it, and I want to thank you again, all of you, so many of you for coming out. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.